She made a slighting puh with her mouth, and went out of the house, and never came in again till the king went to Sir Daniel Harvey's to pray her. And so she is come today, when one would think his mind should be full of some other cares, having but this morning broken up such a parliament, with so much discontent and so many wants upon him, and but yesterday heard such a sermon against adultery. But it seems she hath told the king that whoever did get it, he should own it. And the bottom of the quarrel is this. She is fallen in love with young Jermyn, who hath of late lain with her oftener than the king, and is now going to marry my Lady Falmouth. The king, he is mad at her entertaining Jermyn, and she is mad at Jermyn's going to marry from her. So they are all mad, and thus the kingdom is governed. And they say it is labouring to make breaches between the Duke of Richmond and his lady, that the king may get her to him. But he tells me for certain that nothing is more sure than that the king and Duke of York, and the Chancellor, are defeated. To his house, and before dinner, he and I did discourse of the business of freight, wherein I am so much concerned. Above £100 for myself, and in my over-hasty making a bill out for the rest for him. But he resolves to move Creed in it, which troubled me much. And Creed by and by comes, and after dinner he did, but in the most cunning, ingenious manner, do his business with Creed by bringing it in by the by, that the most subtle man in the world could never have done it better. And I must say that he is a most witty, cunning man, and one that I am most afeard of in my conversation, though in all serious matters of business, the veriest fool that ever I met with. The bill was produced and a copy given Creed, whereupon he writ his intrator upon the original, and I hope it will pass. At least I am now put to it that I must stand by it and justify it. But I pray God it may never come to the test. Thence, between vexed and joyed, away, and my wife and I to church, and after church to Sir William Penn, and there sat and talked with him. And the perfidious rogue seems, as he doth always, mightily civil to us, though I know he hates and envies us. So home to supper, prayers and to bed. The 9th of May. Up and to my office all the morning, and there saw several things done in my work, to my great content. And at noon, home to dinner, and after dinner in Sir William Penn's coach, he set my wife and I down at the New Exchange, and after buying something, we walked to my Lady Sandwich, who, good lady, is now, thanks be to God, so well as to sit up and send to us, if we were not afeard to come to her. So we did, but she was mightily against my wife's coming so near her, though, poor wretch, she is as well as ever she was as to the measles, and nothing can I see upon her face. There we sat talking with her above 3 hours, till 6, talking with Mr. Slingsby, who is a very ingenious person, about the mint and coinage of money. Among other things, he argues that there being £700,000 coined in the rump time, and by all the treasurers of that time, it being their opinion that the rump money was in all payments, one with another, about a tenth part of all their money. Then, says he to my question, the nearest guess we can make is that the money passing up and down in business is £7,000,000. To another question of mine, he made me fully understand that the old law of prohibiting bullion to be exported is, and ever was, a folly and an injury rather than good. Arguing thus, that if the exportations exceed importations, then the balance must be brought home in money, which, when our merchants know cannot be carried out again, they will forbear to bring home in money, but let it lie abroad for trade or keep in foreign banks. Or if our importations exceed our export, not knowing what yet to make of it, home, calling for my Lord's Cook's 3 volumes at my bookseller's, and so home, where I find a new cookmaid, her name is Alice, that promises very little. So to my office, where late about drawing up a proposal for Captain Taylor for him to deliver to the city, about his building the new ship, which I have done well, and I hope will do the business. And so home to supper and to bed. The 30th of March. Up and to my Lord Ashley, but did nothing, and to Sir Philip Warwick and spoke with him about business, and so back to the office, where all the morning. At noon, home to dinner, and thence to the Tangier Committee. Where, Lord, to see how they did run into the giving of Sir John Lawson, who is come to town today to get this business done, £4,000 about his mole business, and we're going to give him 4 shillings per yard more, which arises in the whole mole to £36,000, is a strange thing. Desirous and labouring all they can to get an army, whatever the King says to the Parliament, and he believes that they are at last resolved to stand and fall all three together. So that he says in terms that the match of the Duke of York with the Chancellor's daughter hath undone the nation. He tells me also that the King hath not greater enemies in the world than those of his own family, for there is not an officer in the house almost but curses him for letting them starve, and there is not a farthing of money to be raised for the buying them bread. Having done talking with him, I to Westminster Hall, and there talked and wandered up and down till the evening, to no purpose there, and to the Swan, and so till the evening, and so home, and there to walk in the garden with my wife, telling her of my losing 300 a year by my place that I am to part with, which doth a little trouble me, but we must live with somewhat more thrift, and so home to supper, and to play on the flageolet, which she doth do very prettily, and so to bed. Many guns stations. Then, to keep credit, the merchants will and must find ways of carrying out money by stealth, which is a most easy thing to do, and is everywhere done, and therefore the law against it signifies nothing in the world, besides that it is seen that where money is free, there is great plenty, where it is restrained, as here, there is great want, as in Spain. These and many other fine discourses I had from him. Thence by coach home to see Sir John Minnis first, who is still sick, and I doubt worse than he seems to be. Mistress Turner here took me into her closet, and there did give me a glass of most pure water, and showed me her rock, which indeed is a very noble thing, but a very bauble. So away to my office, where late busy, and then home to supper and to bed. The 28th of January. Up and to my office, where all the morning, and then home to dinner, and after dinner abroad. Walked to Paul's Churchyard, but my book o'clock, of several things with great pleasure. And so away, and home by coach, buying several things for my wife in our way home. And so, after looking what had been done in my office today with good content, home to supper and to bed. But strange how I cannot get anything to take place in my mind, while my work lasts at my office. This day my wife and I, in our way to Paternoster Row to buy things, called upon Mr. Holyard to advise upon her drying up her issue in her leg, which inclines of itself to dry up, and he admits of it that it should be dried up. The 10th of May. Up and at my office, looking after my workmen all the morning, and after the office was done, did the same at night, and so home to supper and to bed. The 11th of May. Up and all day, both forenoon and afternoon, at my office, to see it finished by the joiner, and washed, and everything in as the Strand, and myself got as far as Ludgate by all the bonfires, but with a great deal of trouble. And there the coachman desired that I would release him, for he dares not go further for the fires. So he would have had a shilling or sixpence for bringing of me so far, but I had about threepence about me, and did give him that. In Paul's Churchyard I called at Curtin's, and there they had got a mass book for me, which I bought, and cost me 12 shillings. And when I came home sat up late and read in it, with great pleasure to my wife to hear that she long ago was so well acquainted with. So to bed. I observed this night very few bonfires in the city, not above 3 in all London, for the Queen's coming, whereby I guess that, as I believed before, her coming doth please but very few. The 3rd of November, Saturday. At home all the morning, in the afternoon to Whitehall, but the latter by chance was stopped, the former was given. Thence to see Mistress Martin, whose husband, being it seems gone away, and as she is informed he hath another woman whom he uses and hath long done as a wife, she is mighty reserved, and resolved to keep herself so till the return of her husband, which is a pleasant thing to think of her. Thence home and to my office, where late, and to bed. The 31st of March. Up betimes and walked to my Lord Ashley, and there, with Creed, after long waiting, spoke with him, and was civilly used by him. Thence to Sir Philip Warwick, and then to visit my Lord of Falmouth, who did also receive me pretty civilly, but not as I expected. He, I perceived, believing that I had undertaken to justify Povey's accounts, taking them upon myself. But I rectified him therein. So to my Lady Sandwich's to dinner, and up to her chamber after dinner, and there discoursed about Sir Jorke's not bound, which vexed me. So home to my office again, where very late about business, and so home to supper and to bed, my cold continuing in a great degree upon me still. This day I receive a good sum of money due to me upon one score or another from Sir George Carteret, among others to clear all my matters about colours, wherein a month or two since I was so embarrassed, and, I thank God, I find myself to have got clear by that commodity £50, and something more, and earned it with dear pains and care, and issuing of my own money, and saved the King near £100 in it. The 29th of January, Lord's Day. Up and to my office, where all the morning putting papers to rights, which now grow upon my hand. At noon dined at home, all the afternoon at my business again. In the evening comes Mr. Andrews and Hill, and we up to my chamber, and there good music, though my great cold made it the less pleasing to me. Then Mr. Hill were heard this afternoon, it seems, at Whitehall and in the Temple Garden, very plain. But what it should be, nobody knows, unless the Dutch be driving our ships up the river. Tomorrow we shall know. The 30th of July. Up and to the office, where we sat busy all the morning, at noon home to dinner, where Daniel and his wife with us, come to see whether I could get him any employment. But I am so far from it that I have the trouble upon my mind how to dispose of Mr. Gibson, and one or two more I am concerned for in the victualling business, which are to be now discharged. After dinner by coach to Whitehall, calling on two or three tradesmen and paying their bills. And so to Whitehall to the Treasury Chamber, where I did speak with the Lords, and did my business about getting them to assent to 10% interest on the 11 months' tax, but find them mightily put to it for money. Here I do hear that there are three Lords more to be added to them, my Lord Bridgewater, my Lord Anglesey, and my Lord Chamberlain. Having done order, and indeed now my closet is very convenient and pleasant for me. My Uncle White came to me to my office this afternoon to speak with me about Mr. Mace's business again, and from me went to my house to see my wife. And strange to think that my wife should by and by send for me after he was gone, to tell me that he should begin discourse of her want of children, and his also, and how he thought it would be best for him and her to have one between them. And he would give her £500 either in money or jewel beforehand, and make the child his heir. He commended her body, and discoursed that for all he knew the thing was lawful. She says she did give him a very warm answer, such as he did not excuse himself by saying that he said this in jest, but told her that since he saw what her mind was, he would say no more to her of it, and desired her to make no words of it. It seemed he did say all this in a kind of counterfeit laugh, but by all words my lord and lady were gone to kiss the Queen's hand. To Westminster Hall, where I met with Tom Doling, and we too took Mistress Lane to the alehouse, where I made her angry with commending of Tom Newton and her new sweetheart, to be both too good for her, so that we parted with much anger, which made Tom and I good sport. So home to write letters by the post, and so to bed. The 4th of November, Lord's Day. In the morn to our own church, where Mr. Mills did begin to nibble at the common prayer, by saying, Glory be to the Father, etc., after he had read the two psalms. but the people have been so little used to it that they could not tell what to answer. This declaration of the king's doth give the presbyters some satisfaction, and a pretence to read the common prayer, which they could not do before because of their former preaching against it. After dinner to Westminster, where I went to my Carteret's son, in proposition between us two for my Lady Jemima. So to Povey, and with him spent the afternoon very busy, till I was weary of following this and neglecting my navy business. So at night called my wife at my lady's, and so home, to my office, and there made up my month's accounts, which, God be praised, rise to £1,300, which I bless God for. So after 12 o'clock, home to supper and to bed. I find Creed mightily transported by my Lord of Falmouth's kind words to him, and saying that he hath a place in his intention for him, which he believes will be considerable. A witty man he is in every respect, but of no good nature, nor a man ordinarily to be dealt with. My Lady Castlemaine is sick again. People think slipping her filly. April 1665. The first. All the other going away, and I to supper alone, my wife not appearing. Our discourse upon the particular vain humours of Mr. Povey, which are very extraordinary indeed. After supper I to Sir William Batten's, where I found him, Sir William Batten, Sir John Robinson, Sir Richard Ford and Captain Cock, and Mr. Fenn, Jr. Here a great deal of sorry disordered talk about the Trinity House men their being exempted from land service. But, Lord, to see how void of method and sense their discourse was, and in what heat, insomuch as Sir Richard Ford, who we judge some of us to be a little foxed, fell into very high terms with Sir William Batten, and then with Captain Cock, so that I see that no man is wise at all times. Thence home to prayers and to bed. The 30th of January. This is solemnly kept as a fast all over the city, but I kept my house, putting my closet to rights again, having laid my lord, and having spoke with him, I went to the abbey, where the first time that ever I heard the organs in a cathedral. Thence to my lord's, where I found Mr. Pierce the chirurgeon, and with him and Mr. Shepley, in our way calling at the bell to see the 7 Flanders mares that my lord hath bought lately, to his house, where we drank several bottles of Hull ale. Much company I find to come to her, and cannot wonder at it, for she is very pretty and wanton. Thence to my father's, where I find my mother in greater and greater pain of the stone. I stayed long and drank with them, and so home and to bed. My wife seemed very pretty today, it being the first time that I have given her leave to wear a black patch. The 5th of November. Office day. Being disappointed of money, we failed of going to Deptford to pay off the Henrietta today. Dined at home, all the morning very busy at the office, preparing a last year's accounts for my Lord Treasurer. At noon, ate a bit and stepped to Sir Philip Warwick, by coach to my Lord Treasurer's, and after some private conference and examining of my papers with him, I did return into the city, and to Sir George Carteret, whom I find with the commissioners of prizes, dining at Captain Cox's in Broad Street, very merry. Among other tricks, there did come a blind fiddler to the door, and Sir George Carteret did go to the door and lead the blind fiddler by the hand in. Thence, with Sir George Carteret to my Lord Treasurer's, and by and by come Sir William Batten and Sir John Minnis, and anon we come to my lord, and there did lay open the expense for the 6 months past, and an estimate of the 7 months to come, to November next, the first arising to above £500,000, and the latter will, as we judge, come to above 1,000,000. But to see how my Lord Treasurer did bless himself, crying he could do no more than he could, nor give more money than it's that passed, which I cannot now so well set down, it is plain to me that he was in good earnest, and that I fear all his kindness is but only his lust to her. What to think of it of a sudden I know not, but I think not to take notice yet of it to him till I've thought better of it. So, with my mind and head a little troubled, I received a letter from Mr. Coventry about a mast for the Duke's yacht, which, with other business, makes me resolve to go betimes to Woolwich tomorrow. So to supper and to bed. The 12th of May. Up by 4 o'clock and by water to Woolwich, where did some business and walked to Greenwich. Good discourse with Dean, best part of the way. There met by appointment Commissioner Pett, and with him to Deptford, where also did some business. And so home to my office, and at noon Mistress Hunt and her cousin, child, and maid came and dined with me, my wife sick of those in bed. I was troubledly put it out of order in removing my books and things in order to being made clean. At this all day, and at night to my office there to do some business. And being late at it comes Mercer to me to tell me that my wife was in bed, and desired me to come home, for they hear, and have night after night lately heard, noises over their head upon the leads. Now it is strange to think how, knowing that I have a great sum of money in my house, this puts me into a most mighty affright, that for more than 2 hours I could not almost tell what to do or say, but feared this and that, and remembered that this evening I saw a woman and 2 men stand suspiciously in the entry in the dark. I, calling to them, they made me only this answer. The woman said that the men came to see her. But who she was, I could not tell. The truth is, my house is mighty dangerous, having so many ways to be come to, and at my windows over the stairs, to see who goes up and down. But if I escape to-night, I will run my business, I to Creed's chamber, and thence out to Whitehall with him, in our way meeting with Mr. Cooling, my Lord Chamberlain's secretary, on horseback, who stopped to speak to us, and he proved very drunk, and did talk, and would have talked, all night with us. I not being able to break loose from him, he holding me so by the hand. But, Lord, to see his present humour, how he swears at every word, and talks of the King and my Lady Castlemaine in the plainest words in the world. And from him I gather that the story I learned yesterday is true, that the King hath declared that he did not get the child of which she is conceived at this time, he having not, as he says, lain with her this half year. But she told him, God damn me, but you shall own it. It seems he is jealous of Jermyn, and she loves him, so that the thoughts of his marrying of my Lady Falmouth puts her into fits of the mother, and he, it seems, hath lain with her from time to time continually for a good while, and once, and at home all the day, and at the office at night, to make up an account of what the debts of 19 of the 25 ships that should have been paid off is increased since the adjournments of the Parliament, they being to sit again tomorrow. This 5th of November is observed exceeding well in the city, and at night great bonfires and fireworks. At night Mr. Moore came and sat with me, and there I took a book, and he did instruct me in many law notions, in which I took great pleasure. To bed. The 6th of November. In the morning with Sir William Batten and Penn, by water to Westminster, where at my Lord's I met with Mr. Creed, and with him to see my Lord's picture, now almost done, and thence to Westminster Hall, where we found the Parliament met to-day. And thence, meeting with Mr. Chetwynd, I took them to the Sun, and did give them a barrel of oysters, and have good discourse. Among other things Mr. Chetwynd had, if the occasion and expense were never so great, which is but a sad story, and then to hear how like a passionate and ignorant ass Sir George Carteret did harangue upon the abuse of tickets, did make me mad almost, and yet was fain to hold my tongue. Thence home, vexed mightily to see how simply our greatest ministers do content themselves to understand and do things, while the King's service in the meantime lies a-bleeding. At my office late, writing letters till ready to drop down asleep, with my late sitting up late, and running up and down a days. So to bed. The 2nd of April, Lord's Day. At my office all the morning, renewing my vows in writing, and then home to dinner, All the afternoon, Mr. Tasbra, one of Mr. Povey's clerks, with me about his master's accounts. In the evening, Mr. Andrews and Hill sung, but supped not with me. Then, after supper, to bed. It, but, however, could not help it, but attended them, till after dinner, and then to the office, and there sat all the afternoon, and by a letter to me this afternoon from Mr. Coventry, I see the first appearance of a war with Holland. So home and betimes to bed, because of rising tomorrow. The 13th of May. Up before 3 o'clock, and a little after upon the water, it being very light as at noon, and a bright sun rising. But by and by a rainbow appeared, the first that ever in a morning I saw, and then it fell a-raining a little, but held up again. And I to Woolwich, where before all the men came to work, I with Mr. Dean spent 2 hours upon the new ship, informing myself in the names and natures of many parts of her, to my great content, and so back again without doing anything else. And after shifting myself, away to Westminster, looking after Mr. Mays's business and others. In the painted chamber I heard a fine conference between the sum of the two houses, upon the bill told me how he did fear that this late business of the Duke of York's will prove fatal to my Lord Chancellor. From thence Mr. Creed and I to Wilkinson's, and dined together, and in great haste thence to our office, where we met all commonly, for the sale of 2 ships by an inch of candle, the first time that ever I saw any of this kind, where I observed how they do invite one another, and at last how they all do cry, and we have much to do to tell who did cry last. The ships were the Indian, sold for £1,300, and the Half Moon, sold for £830. Home and fell a-reading of the trials of the late men that were hanged for the king's death, and found good satisfaction in reading thereof. At night to bed, and my wife and I did fall out about the dog's being put down into the cellar, which I have a mind to have done because of his fouling the house, and I'm idiot. God preserve us this night safe. So at almost 2 o'clock, I home to my house, and in great fear to bed, thinking every running of a mouse really a thief, and so to sleep, very brokenly all night long, and found all safe in the morning. The 31st of January. Up and with Sir William Batten to Westminster, where to speak at the house with my Lord Bellis's, and am cruelly vexed to see myself put upon business so uncertainly, about getting ships for Tangier being ordered, a servile thing almost every day. So to the change, back by coach with Sir William Batten, and thence to the Crown, a tavern hard by, with Sir William Ryder and Cutler, where we alone, a very good dinner, thence home to the office, and there all the afternoon late. The office being up, my wife sent for me, and what was it but to tell me how Jane carries herself, and I must put her away presently. The 3rd of April. Up and to the Duke of Albemarle and Whitehall, where much business, thence home and to dinner, and then with Creed, my wife, and Mercer to a play at the Duke's of my Lord Orrery's called Mustapha, which, being not good, made Betterton's part and Ianthe's but ordinary too, so that we were not contented with it at all. Thence home and to the office a while, and then home to supper and to bed. All the pleasure of the play was, the King and my Lady Castlemaine was there, and pretty witty Nell at the King's house, and the younger Marshal sat next us, which pleased me mightily. The 4th of April. All the morning at the office busy, at noon to the change, and then went up to the change to buy a pair of cotton stockings, which I did at the husband's shop of the most pretty woman there, who did also invite me to buy some linen of her, and I was glad of the occasion, and bespoke some bands of her, intending to make her my seamstress. This cooling says the king had like to have taken him a bed with her, but that he was fain to creep under the bed into her closet. He says that for a good while the king's greatest pleasure hath been with his fingers, being able to do no more. But it is a pretty thing, he told us, how the king, once speaking of the Duke of York's being mastered by his wife, said to some of the company by that he would go no more abroad with this Tom Otter, meaning the Duke of York and his wife. Tom Killigrew, being by, answered, "Sir," says he, "pray, which is the best for a man to be, a Tom Otter to his wife or to his mistress?" meaning the king's being so to my Lady Castlemaine. Thus he went on, and speaking then of my Lord Sandwich, whom he professed to love exceedingly, says Cooling, "I know not what, but he is a man, methinks, that I could love for himself, without other regards, and by your favour," says he. "By God, there is nothing to be beloved for conventicles." The lords would be freed from having their houses searched by any but the Lord Lieutenant of the county, and upon being found guilty, to be tried only by their peers. And thirdly, would have it added that whereas the bill says that that among other things shall be a conventicle, wherein any such meeting is found doing anything contrary to the liturgy of the Church of England, they would have it added, or practice. The Commons to the Lords said that they knew not what might hereafter be found out, which might be called the practice of the Church of England, for there are many things may be said to be the practice of the Church, which were never established by any law, either common, statute, or canon, as singing of psalms, binding up prayers at the end of the Bible, and prayings extempore, before and after sermon. And though these are things indifferent, yet things for aught they at present know may be started which may be said to be the practice of the Church, which would not be fit to allow. For the Lord's privileges would have my will. And so we went to bed, and lay all night in a quarrel. This night I was troubled all night with a dream that my wife was dead, which made me that I slept ill all night. The 7th of November, office day. This day my father came to dine at my house, but being sent for in the morning, I could not stay, but went by water to my lord, where I dined with him, and he in a very merry humour, present Mr. Borfitt and child. At dinner he, in discourse of the great opinion of the virtue, gratitude, which he did account the greatest thing in the world to him, and hath therefore in his mind been often troubled in the late times how to answer his gratitude to the king who raised his father, did say that that was it that did bring him to his obedience to the king, and did also bless himself with his good fortune, in comparison to what it was when I was with him in the Sound, she being one of the prettiest and most modest-looked women that ever I did see. Dined at home, and to the office, where, very late, till I was ready to fall down asleep, and did several times nod in the middle of my letters. The 5th of April. This day was kept publicly by the King's command as a fast day against the Dutch war, and I, betimes with Mr. Tooker, whom I have brought into the navy to serve us as a husband to see goods timely shipped off from hence, to the fleet and other places, and took him with me to Woolwich and Deptford, where, by business, I have been hindered a great while of going, did a very great deal of business, and then home, and there, by promise, find Creed, and he and my wife, Mercer, and I by coach to take the air, and where we have formerly been, at Hackney, did there eat some pullets we carried with us, and some other things of the house, and after a game or two at shuffleboard, home. And Creed lay with me, but I did hear both sides, and find my wife much in fault. And the grounds of all the difference is my wife's fondness of Tom, to the being displeased with all the house beside to defend the boy, which vexes me, but I will cure it. Many high words between my wife and I, but the wench shall go. But I will take a course with the boy, for I fear I have spoilt him already. Thence to the office, to my accounts, and there, at once to ease my mind, I have made myself debtor to Mr. Povey for the £117.5, got with so much joy the last month. But seeing that it is not like to be kept without some trouble and question, I do even discharge my mind of it. And so, if I come now to refund it, as I fear I shall now be ne'er a whit the poorer for it, though yet it is some trouble to me to be poorer by such a sum than I thought myself a month since. But, however, A quiet mind, and to be sure of my own, is worth all. The Lord be praised for what I have.
And all our lives we are sinking through it. When we've got all the way through, then we are what's called dead. We've got into the dark part inside, the real globe. If your God exists, he's not in the globe. He's outside, like a moon. As we pass into the interior, we pass out of his ken. He doesn't follow us in. You would express it by saying he's not in time, which you think comforting. In other words, he stays put, out in the light and air outside. But we are in time. We move with the times. That is, from his point of view, we move away into what he regards as non-entity, where he never follows. That is all there is to us, all there ever was. He may be there in what you call life, or he may not. What difference does it make? We're not going to be there for long. Well, that could hardly be the whole story, said Ransom. If the whole universe were like that, then we, being parts of it, would feel at home in such a universe. The very fact that it strikes us as monstrous. Yes, interrupted Weston, that would be all very well if it wasn't that reasoning itself is only valid as long as you stay in the rind. It has nothing to do with the real universe. Even the ordinary scientists, like what I used to be myself, are beginning to find that out. Haven't you seen the real meaning of all this modern stuff about the dangers of extrapolation and bent space and the indeterminacy of the atom? They don't say in so many words, of course, but what they're getting to, even before they die nowadays, is what all men get to when they're dead, the knowledge that reality is neither rational nor consistent nor anything else. In a sense, you might say it isn't there. Real and unreal, true and false. They're all only on the surface. They give way the moment you press them. If all this were true, said Ransom, what would be the point of saying it? Or of anything else, replied Weston. The only point in anything is that there isn't any point. Why do ghosts want to frighten? Because they are ghosts. What else is there to do? I get the idea, said Ransom, that the account a man gives of the universe or of any other building depends very much on where he is standing. But specially, said Weston, on whether he's inside or out. All the things you like to dwell upon are outsides. A planet like our own, or like Perelandra, for instance, or a beautiful human body. All the colours and pleasant shapes are merely where it ends, where it ceases to be. Inside, what do you get? Darkness, worms, heat, pressure, salt, suffocation, stink. They ploughed forward for a few minutes in silence over waves which were now growing larger. The fish seemed to be making little headway. Of course you don't care, said Weston. What do you people in the Rind care about us? You haven't been pulled down yet. It's like a dream I once had, though I didn't know then how true it was. I dreamed I was lying dead, you know, nicely laid out in the ward in a nursing home with my face settled by the undertaker and big lilies in the room. And then a sort of a person who was all falling to bits, like a tramp, you know, only it was himself, not his clothes, that was coming to pieces, came and stood at the foot of the bed, just hating me. All right, he said, all right. You think you're mighty fine with your clean sheet and your shiny coffin being got ready. I began like that. We all did. Just wait and see what you come down to in the end. Really, said Ransom, I think you might just as well shut up. Then there's spiritualism, said Weston, ignoring this suggestion. I used to think it all nonsense, but it isn't. It's all true. You've noticed that all pleasant accounts of the dead are traditional or philosophical? What actual experience discovers is quite different. Ectoplasm, slimy films coming out of a medium's belly and making great chaotic tumble-down faces, automatic writing producing reams of rubbish. "Are you Weston?" said Ransom, suddenly turning upon his companion. The persistent, mumbling voice, so articulate that you had to listen to it, and yet so inarticulate that you had to strain your ears to follow what it said, was beginning to madden him. "Oh, don't be angry," said the voice. "There's no good being angry with me. I thought you might be sorry. My God, Ransom, it's awful. You don't understand. Right down under layers and layers, buried alive, you try to connect things and can't. They take your head off, and you can't even look back on what life was like in the Rind because you know it never did mean anything even from the beginning." "What are you?" cried Ransom. "How do you know what death is like? God knows I'd help you if I could, but give me the facts. Where have you been these few days?" "Hush," said the other suddenly. "What's that?" Ransom listened. Certainly there did seem to be a new element in the great concourse of noises with which they were surrounded. At first he could not define it. The seas were very big now, and the wind was strong. All at once his companion reached out his hand and clutched Ransom's arm. "Oh, my God!" he cried. "Oh, Ransom, Ransom, we shall be killed, killed and put back under the rind. Ransom, you promised to help me. Don't let them get me again." "Shut up," said Ransom in disgust, for the creature was wailing and blubbering so that he could hear nothing else, and he wanted very much to identify the deeper note that had mingled with the piping wind and roar of water. "Breakers!" said Weston. "Breakers, you fool! Can't you hear? There's a country over there. There's a rocky coast. Look, there. No, to your right. We shall be smashed into a jelly. Look, oh God, here comes the dark." And the dark came. Horror of death such as he had never known, horror of the terrified creature at his side, descended upon Ransom. Finally, horror with no definite object. In a few minutes he could see through the jet-black night the luminous cloud of foam. From the way in which it shot steeply upward, he judged it was breaking on cliffs. Invisible birds with a shriek and flurry passed low overhead. "Are you there, Weston?" he shouted. "What cheer? Pull yourself together. All that stuff you've been talking is lunacy. Say a child's prayer if you can't say a man's. Repent your sins. Take my hand. There are hundreds of mere boys on earth facing death this moment. We'll do very well." His hand was clutched in the darkness, rather more firmly than he wished. "I can't bear it! I can't bear it!" came Weston's voice. "Steady now, none of that!" he shouted back, for Weston had suddenly gripped his arm with both hands. "I can't bear it!" came the voice again. "Hey!" said Ransom. "Let go! What the devil are you doing?" And as he spoke, strong arms had plucked him from the saddle, had wrapped him round in a terrible embrace just below his thighs, and, clutching uselessly at the smooth surface of the fish's body, he was dragged down. The waters closed over his head, and still his enemy pulled him down into the warm depth, and down farther yet to where it was no longer warm. Chapter 14 "I can't hold my breath any longer," thought Ransom. "I can't. I can't." Cold, slimy things slid upwards over his agonized body. He decided to stop holding his breath, to open his mouth and die. But his will did not obey this decision. Not only his chest, but his temples felt as if they were going to burst. It was idle to struggle. His arms met no adversary, and his legs were pinioned. He became aware that they were moving upwards, but this gave him no hope. The surface was too far away. He could not hold out till they reached it. In the immediate presence of death, all ideas of the afterlife were withdrawn from his mind. The mere abstract proposition, "This is a man dying," floated before him in an unemotional way. Suddenly a roar of sound rushed back upon his ears, intolerable boomings and clangings. His mouth opened automatically. He was breathing again. In a pitch darkness full of echoes, he was clutching what seemed to be gravel and kicking wildly to throw off the grip that still held his legs. Then he was free and fighting once more, a blind struggle half in and half out of the water on what seemed to be a pebbly beach, with sharper rocks here and there that cut his feet and elbows. The blackness was filled with gasping curses, now in his own voice, now in Weston's, with yelps of pain, thudding concussions, and the noise of laboured breath. In the end he was astride of the enemy. He pressed its sides between his knees till its ribs cracked, and clasped his hands round its throat. Somehow he was able to resist its fierce tearing at his arms, to keep on pressing. Once before he had had to press like this, but that had been on an artery, to save life, not to kill. It seemed to last for ages. Long after the creature's struggles had ceased, he did not dare to relax his grip. Even when he was quite sure that it breathed no longer, he retained his seat on its chest, and kept his tired hands, though now loosely, on its throat. He was nearly fainting himself, but he counted 1,000 before he would shift his posture. Even then he continued to sit on its body. He did not know whether in the last few hours the spirit which had spoken to him was really Weston's, or whether he had been the victim of a ruse. Indeed, it made little difference. There was, no doubt, a confusion of persons in damnation. What pantheists falsely hoped of heaven, bad men really received in hell. They were melted down into their master, as a lead soldier slips down and loses his shape in the ladle held over the gas ring. The question whether Satan, or one whom Satan has digested, is acting on any given occasion, has in the long run no clear significance. In the meantime, the great thing was not to be tricked again. There was nothing to be done then, except to wait for the morning. From the roar of echoes all about him, he concluded that they were in a very narrow bay between cliffs. How they had ever made it was a mystery. The morning must be many hours distant. This was a considerable nuisance. He determined not to leave the body till he had examined it by daylight, and perhaps taken further steps to make sure that it could not be reanimated. Till then he must pass the time as best he could. The pebbly beach was not very comfortable, and when he tried to lean back he found a jagged wall. Fortunately, he was so tired that for a time the mere fact of sitting still contented him. But this phase passed. He tried to make the best of it. He determined to give up guessing how the time was going. The only safe answer, he told himself, is to think of the earliest hour you can suppose possible, and then assume the real time is 2 hours earlier than that. He beguiled himself by recapitulating the whole story of his adventure in Perelandra. He recited all that he could remember of the Iliad, the Odyssey, the Aeneid, the Chanson de Roland, Paradise Lost, the Kalevala, the Hunting of the Snark, and a rhyme about Germanic sound laws which he had composed as a freshman. He tried to spend as long as he could hunting for the lines he could not remember. He set himself a chess problem. He tried to rough out a chapter for a book he was writing, but it was all rather a failure. These things went on, alternating with periods of dogged inactivity, until it seemed to him that he could hardly remember a time before that night. He could scarcely believe that even to a bored and wakeful man 12 hours could appear so long. And the noise, the gritty, slippery discomfort. It was very odd, now he came to think of it, that this country should have none of those sweet night breezes which he had met everywhere else in Perelandra. It was odd, too, but this thought came to him what seemed hours later, that he had not even the phosphorescent wave crests to feed his eyes on. Very slowly a possible explanation of both facts dawned on him, and it would also explain why the darkness lasted so long. The idea was too terrible for any indulgence of fear. Controlling himself, he rose stiffly to his feet and began picking his steps along the beach. His progress was very slow, but presently his outstretched arms touched perpendicular rock. He stood on tiptoe and stretched his hands up as far as he could. They found nothing but rock. "Don't get the wind up," he said to himself. He started groping his way back. He came to the unmanned body, passed it, and went beyond it round the opposite beach. It curved rapidly, and here, before he had gone 20 paces, his hands, which he was holding above his head, met not a wall, but a roof of rock. A few paces farther, and it was lower. Then he had to stoop. A little later, and he had to go on his hands and knees. It was obvious that the roof came down and finally met the beach. Sick with despair, he felt his way back to the body and sat down. The truth was now beyond doubt. There was no good waiting for the morning. There would be no morning here till the end of the world, and perhaps he had already waited a night and a day. The clanging echoes, the dead air, the very smell of the place all confirmed this. He and his enemy, when they sank, had clearly, by some hundredth chance, been carried through a hole in the cliffs well below water level, and come up on the beach of a cavern. Was it possible to reverse the process? He went down to the water's edge, or rather, as he groped his way down to where the shingle was wet, the water came up to meet him. It thundered over his head and far up behind him, and then receded with a tug which he only resisted by spread-eagling himself on the beach and gripping the stones. It would be useless to plunge into that. He would merely have his ribs broken against the opposite wall of the cave. If one had light and a high place to dive from, it was just conceivable one might get down to the bottom and strike the exit, but very doubtful. And anyway, one had no light. Although the air was not very good, he supposed that his prison must be supplied with air from somewhere, but whether from any aperture that he could possibly reach was another matter. He turned at once and began exploring the rock behind the beach. At first it seemed hopeless, but the conviction that caves may lead you anywhere dies hard, and after some time his groping hands found a shelf about 3 feet high. He stepped up on it. He had expected it to be only a few inches deep, but his hands could find no wall before him.
Very cautiously he took some paces forward. His right foot touched something sharp. He whistled with the pain and went on even more cautiously. Then he found vertical rock, smooth as high as he could reach. He turned to his right and presently lost it. He turned left and began to go forward again, and almost at once stubbed his toe. After nursing it for a moment, he went down on hands and knees. He seemed to be among boulders, but the way was practicable. For 10 minutes or so he made fairly good going, pretty steeply upward, sometimes on slippery shingle, sometimes over the tops of the big stones. Then he came to another cliff. There appeared to be a shelf on this, about 4 feet up, but this time a really shallow one. He got onto it somehow and glued himself to the face, feeling out to left and right for further grips. When he found one and realized that he was now about to attempt some real climbing, he hesitated. He remembered that what was above him might be a cliff which, even in daylight and properly clothed, he would never dare to attempt. But hope whispered that it might equally well be only 7 feet high, and that a few minutes of coolness might bring him into those gently winding passages up into the heart of a mountain which had, by now, won such a firm place in his imagination. He decided to go on. What worried him was not, in fact, the fear of falling, but the fear of cutting himself off from the water. Starvation he thought he could face, not thirst. But he went on. For some minutes he did things which he had never done on earth. Doubtless he was in one way helped by the darkness. He had no real sensation of height and no giddiness. On the other hand, to work by touch alone made crazy climbing. Doubtless if anyone had seen him, he would have appeared at one moment to take mad risks and at another to indulge in excessive caution. He tried to keep out of his mind the possibility that he might be climbing merely towards a roof. After about a quarter of an hour, he found himself on a wide horizontal surface, either a much deeper shelf or the top of the precipice. He rested here for a while and licked his cuts. Then he got up and felt his way forward.